She was just so busy. And then after the children slept, after they took so much time from her and energy, she just sat down. I told her, huh? I said, you were right. Human beings do need this. We need to just sometimes to sit down, gather our thoughts.
And recharge.
And recharge. Just, you know, leave out everything. You know, if we stay with all this, you know, connections, especially on social media, where you're connected with people from America, and you're connected from people in China, and you're connected from people in Iran, and you're connected from people in Lebanon, and then you're just everywhere. You're everywhere. That takes energy. That takes time. And we need to, you know, sometimes just sit down by ourselves.
For sure. How about you, Sayyidna? Do you prefer to be alone most of the times, or do you appreciate company?
I do appreciate company if they are company. There are people, because they're sitting around you, it doesn't make them company. There are specific people that you feel you are in sync with them, you're in touch with them on a
compatible,
more than compatible. Sometimes you have friends that are compatible with them, but more than an hour and they become annoying. But there are those who, if you could use this term, soulmates, or those who are in touch on a spiritual or soul level, those people you never get sick of, I guess. The more time you spend them, the better. But like Brother Habib said, there are times where any human being, doesn't matter who you live with, you do need a bit of space and time. Generally speaking, for me as a person, I am a very introvert. I don't like to socialize as much. I have always been this way, yes. I mean, I do go to gatherings and stuff like that, but me personally, I would rather be by myself. Unless there's a special someone, that's a different. But more than that, no thanks. I'll pass.
Has anyone ever said to you that there's something wrong with you because you're so introverted?
A lot of people have. Yes, I can't deny the fact that people told me that. Even beginning with my own family members, they said to me, there's something. I remember even my dad used to tell me that. I'm like in my closed environment, in my own room or doing my own thing. Even when I'm in the house and there are people, I would like to stay in my own room and not to talk with people. So this has been, I think, since childhood, I've been like that. And I don't know if there are other factors, whether it's right to wrong, is, I don't know. I'm not going to become a therapist for myself. But as far as I'm concerned, that when I'm alone, I'm at peace. Because when I'm not alone,
no one can bother you.
I don't know. Me personally, I'm very sensitive. I get, like, a person might say something to me or do something and I get hurt a lot. So I'd rather to keep myself locked in.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I didn't know you liked that, brother. You know, this is the first time I understand you that way. If someone doesn't, you know, smack me, doesn't bash talk to me,
Brother Habib,
I get kind of like, is this person talking behind my back or something? What's up?
Can I say this about you, Brother Habib? You in Hausa used to wrestle with other students in the courtyard of the Hausa.
That's his love language. Do you think that there's this cookie cutter that we can just put on this dough, which is society, and let everyone fit into the shape of whatever cookie it is that we want to bake, and say it's best if human beings are introverted, or it's best if human beings are extroverted?
Of course, the first thing that popped up to my mind when you said cookie dough and, you know, put the thing, Shrek 2. I don't know why, but
the
Shrek,
Muffin Man?
The movie. Yeah, I think it was because of him. But anyway, Shrek is a good movie. Anyway, but the thing is that human beings are different. Every culture is different. Every person, inside every house, there's a difference. For example, your brother is different from you. Your sister is different from you. Your mother is different from you. Your father is different from you. There are specific traits in every human being that, you know, makes them, I'm going to say in a good way, shine. Makes them distinct from their other members of society, household, or whatever. And is it good for everyone to be an extrovert or an introvert? I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to deal about that. But there are ways of dealing with people. There are ways of, you know, how to be social. And any manner, human beings are social creatures. We need society to, you know, strive. Whether you like it or not. See, for example, when you take a selfie and you're having a long time picking out the emoji good enough for you, what are you doing? You're interacting with society, whether you like it or not. That's up to you. On this basis, Islam has come up with the ideas and mentalities, instructions of how to deal with society, how to deal with, you know, extroverts and how to deal with introverts. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, whether you like it or not, you're going to have to socialize.
To a degree.
You have to socialize.
To get your affairs moving on.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't know why, but I feel like there's this exaggeration on this idea, this concept of socialize, and, you know, we return it to mental illnesses. Some people drag it to a point. You're not sensitive about being sensitive. I know people being sensitive about being sensitive. Yeah. Like, I'm a sensitive person. Don't hurt me about my sensitivity. Right? Mm. No. Habibi, we're human beings. We have to interact. You have to go outside. You have to buy milk. Mm. How do you eat cereal without milk? Anyways.
You can eat it dry.
with warm water.
Now, the idea is, like, we can't shape society or people into being either introvert or extrovert. At the end of the day, no matter how introvert I am, I still have to go out to gatherings. I still have to go sit with people. I have to go
interact with people. Being
who I am, I'm sitting with you guys, right? And I go outside. I have gatherings. I give classes. I give lectures. So I am, you know, constantly with people. But inside me, whether I feel like being alone or not, that's a different issue. But at the end of the day, you have to deal with society based on, you know, your needs basis, I guess.
You guys have very different personality sets, and that just makes this conversation even more interesting. Sayyid Abdullah, when was the last time you felt, I mean, given the fact that you're an introverted person, have there been any times where you felt, okay, I'd rather not be alone? Being alone sucks.
It does. Being alone, I do admit, being alone sucks, and there's no one that knows this concept more than me. So, yeah, so it sucks, but obviously, throughout this loneliness that you're cocooned in, you do feel the urge and the need to be with somebody. Because then, like Brother Habib said, human beings were created from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to be social creatures. We're not alone. We're not cavemen. So there is a longing to someone else. Now, be it a wife, a spouse, like Allah says, sakanun lakum, you know, they are a comfort for you, because at the end of the day, you'll always need that comfort. Always a close friend that you will feel, you know, special towards. So at the end of the day, you do feel, in your times of loneliness, you will definitely feel the urge to be with somebody.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Brother Habib, you are more extroverted than the both of us. And you're actually good at socializing. You're very open. You speak to everyone. You laugh at everything. During these times of socializing, even when it was with the cliques that you do appreciate, did you ever feel like, nah, I just want to get out of here, I want to go home?
There are certain groups that, yeah, like, but it's that point where, like, all right, it's not about me stopping from socializing, it's about me halting myself from being with this environment, with this group. I remember this happened to me last year. Like, I had a group of friends that, for example, we would go for a reading lesson, for a reading session. And then after that, we would go, for example, to either play football or to exercise or do something, you know, just to move. And we were sitting down, we were talking, and, you know, in the middle of it, I just felt like, these guys are not, you know.
Okay.
It's not about stopping from socializing.
Uh-huh. It was the people.
Like, I don't know if I want to continue like this.
All right. Okay. That's interesting. But there's also a hadith, I believe. I'm probably butchering it. You guys know better than I do. That is along the lines of be with the people, but
live with the people in a manner that you live with them with your body. But if your soul is somewhere else.
There we go. Yeah. I knew you'd deliver.
That's the concept of this is something that I wanted to add. What Sayyid Abdullah was stating, that it's hard, it sucks to be, you know, alone. And we have this saying available, if I'm not wrong, it's available in the Surah Al-Kahfi, I'm sure, that the 12th hadith, the long hadith between Imam Kadhim alayhi salam and Hisham al-Hakam, where he's saying the merits of the intellect and mind. And he says that Allah, that these intellectual people, these true intellectual people, will stay away from society. Why? Because of the ignorance that they see from them. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala then gives them the strength to stay, you know, alone.
Isolated.
Yeah, they would rather live in this sucky and, you know, lonely place rather than interact with society who are, you know, do not have any intellect.
Because it's so painful to them, isn't it?
It's painful to be lonely, but it's more painful to be with the ignorant people.
Yep.
That's one thing. And then, therefore, at the end of the day, there's also this concept of, you know, having to interact. In the sayings of Ahl Bayt alayhi salam, a man came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He told him that one of your Shias, one of your followers, he stays at home. He tells him, how does this person teach other people? How does he learn? How does he pray? Because, you know, meaning congregation prayer, yeah, right, and everything. So the one way to combine these two, you know, concepts is that, yes, you live with people with your body, but spiritually, intellectually, mentally, you're not with them. Your body's with them. Your body is with them in the stores. Your body's with them in, you know, in the assemblies and the meetings and everything. But your soul is somewhere else. It's something else. We also have this in the okay, go ahead. The Zasat al-Huquq, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, was also available. All right, anyway.
That was very interesting. And thank you so very much. For all introverts, extroverts, those who prefer to be alone, or those who can't stand it for a single moment, I hope there was some positive takeaway from today's discussion. Until another salam and greeting, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On Monday, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, announced Italy's employment rate reached almost 60% in March, with more than 23 million people in work. The figure is the highest since 2004, when the agency started to keep track of such records. This as the country's economy is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic amid serious concerns over increasing energy prices. Some trade unions have expressed skepticism about the way the data is gathered by the Bureau of Statistics.
The increase in the number of employed people should be evaluated with great caution, as in most cases it's temporary or petty jobs. Employment figures are made to look impressive, to show that the economy has picked up again, but the reality is very much different. Over time, insecure work has become prevalent in Italy, and workers are being blackmailed into accepting longer working hours and low wages.
Another point to consider is the definition of an employed person. For the majority of Western countries' statistical agency, working just 1 hour a week would be enough to be classified as an employed individual. Another report carried out by research institute Censis and trade union UGL shows that Italian salaries fell by over 8% in real terms between 2010 and 2020. The report has also highlighted the problem of in-work poverty in Italy.
Wages are really low, long working hours. It's difficult, very difficult.
Lo dico io personalmente perché...
Who better than me can tell you how hard it is to find a job? I've been looking for work for a year. The only time I found something, I was paid badly and off the books.
Over 13% of employed workers and almost 8% of the self-employed had earnings below the poverty line in 2020, up 3 percentage points compared to 2010. Italy is one of the few European countries without a minimum wage. A boom in temporary and on-call contracts in recent years and fragmentation in union representation have led to an increase in badly paid, undignifying jobs. Max Civili, Rome.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have no diplomatic relations, officially. But for years, extensive behind-the-scenes diplomatic and intelligence cooperation between Tel Aviv and Riyadh has been open secret. Now, it seems that curtains are falling off of the covert relationship. Israeli media have revealed that an Israeli aircraft landed in an airport in Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, late on Monday. The private plane reportedly took off from Tel Aviv. But this is not the first time that this has happened. Last October, another Israeli private jet landed in Riyadh, making it the first time a public flight from Israel has ever landed in a kingdom. This is the latest among improving regional ties for Israel after agreements to normalize ties with four nations, namely the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco and Sudan, were reached in the 2020 Abraham Accords. Tel Aviv and Riyadh opened their airspaces to each other in 2020. Apart from that, Israeli and Saudi officials have recently openly talked about normalizing ties. Last month, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy. He went on to describe Israel as a potential ally with many common interests. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud has also recently told a Hebrew language newspaper that the integration of Israel in the region will be a huge benefit not only for Israel, but for the entire region. Israeli President Isaac Herzog on Monday said in an interview that he likes to visit Saudi Arabia openly and called on Riyadh to join the Abraham Accords and normalize its ties with the regime. In November 2020, it was reported that the then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had secretly visited Saudi Arabia. The warming up of ties comes amid the escalation of tensions in the occupied territories. Israel has increased its raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in recent weeks and attacks Palestinian towns and cities almost every day. Palestinians have increased their operations in response to the crackdown. They have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv in the past 2 months, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Palestinian response to the previous normalization deals has been clear, that it has not helped the resolution of the long-standing conflict in any meaningful way, and that Israeli brutalities, killings, house demolitions, land grabs and desecration of their sanctities have continued regardless. To them, resistance remains the only path leading to the liberation of the occupied territories.
Quran burnings have once again returned to Sweden as far-right Danish activist Rasmus Paludan desecrated the holy book outside Stockholm's central masjid on Sunday. Later that same day, he travelled to Uppsala and attempted to burn another, but local Muslims chased him off, one nearly being run over in the process. Paludan is a notorious leader of a far-right political party which stood in the last Danish elections, receiving just 1.8% of the vote, failing to win a seat. In 2020, he was jailed for racism and other offences. Throughout the month of Ramadan, Paludan has toured Sweden, burning Qurans in several Muslim-majority areas in various cities, sparking 4 days of violent unrest over the Easter weekend. Local Swedish opposition Nuance Party condemned the authorities for allowing the burnings.
Well, actually, in Sweden, you're not allowed to say or do whatever you want. So this concept of freedom of speech is already has its rules and its regulations. For example, 3 years ago, a neo-Nazi party burnt the Pride flag, the flag that the LGBT movement uses. And for that, they were charged for hate speech or hate against a certain people. Nowadays, the politicians, they don't account Muslims into these kind of minorities. On one hand, they're defending other minorities and their rights to be left alone or to not be hated against. And on the other hand, they are defending people who are hating it towards or against Muslims.
There's no word to describe the our disappointment to the other political parties and the public figures that are defending him. We don't see any political parties that are going out and defending the Muslims and that are talking about issues that facing Muslims. So I think that is why this is happening.
Peace and tranquility has returned to Sweden, but tensions remain high as both local Muslims and the Swedish authorities know that the Quran burners will be back. Paludan has made absolutely clear that he intends to run in the Swedish elections this September, and it's very likely that he will bring further unrest back with him. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
International Workers' Day was celebrated in France with hundreds of marches nationwide as leftists of all sorts united to celebrate equality, solidarity, and worker empowerment.
The 1st of May is the International Day for workers to get together and discuss how to defend themselves. It's seemingly the only day where workers mobilize for their rights worldwide, and we see how there are so many countries represented here. Today is more important than any election or particular movement.
In 2020 and 2021, May Day was muted due to the coronavirus pandemic. The celebration is back to full strength this year, and many marchers have an added reason to be politically active. The recent re-election of Emmanuel Macron following a campaign dominated by the far right. Economic stagnation, record inflation, a bitter election campaign with results few are genuinely happy about. Many believe some changes are coming for France. The French left is in the middle of perhaps a major reconstitution. The communists, greens, and socialists are deciding whether or not to join forces behind Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who finished third in the presidential race. Should they unite for the June legislative elections, they could deny Macron absolute control of parliament and thus drastically change his plans for his second term.
I can't recall the last time people felt they were actually voting for someone, rather than voting to eliminate something. But not everyone here accepts this logic of reformism. We workers who produce the wealth need to prove an alternative to this system, like the Yellow Vests do, through consciousness and organization.
Unions, notably quiet during the presidential campaign, were out in big numbers, though far from records. Police, normally elbow-to-elbow with protesters at Yellow Vest demonstrations, gave marchers plenty of room, with few serious confrontations reported. May Day 2019 is often considered the end of the major Yellow Vest demonstrations. Hundreds of arrests, warrantless searches starting from a 150-kilometer radius around Paris, and massive police violence gutted the average person's willingness to join 6 months of enormous anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
People in the Gaza Strip mark this year's Eid al-Fitr holiday for the 16th time under the Israeli blockade. The joyful occasion comes at the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Traditionally, Muslims go to markets several days before Eid to buy gifts, new clothes, and sweets for their loved ones, but many here can't afford that because of the high unemployment and poverty rates. United Nations figures show that 80% of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been relying on handouts in recent years in order to survive.
I'm having a very hard time while trying to buy new clothes for the holiday. I'm on a very tight budget, and I really don't know how to get through this holiday. There is hardly any money in Gaza, and the situation is only getting worse day after day.
For Gazan families, it has been a very tough task to buy Eid items for their children amid the harsh economic situation in the besieged coastal enclave. People scour the markets for hours to try and find affordable gifts for the families.
Most Gazans are broke and can't buy Eid items for their families. Gifts and clothes are very expensive, but we're determined to celebrate this holiday. The Israeli blockade and the last wars will not steal our joy.
For merchants, this Eid season has been one of the worst they had in years. Usually during holidays like Eid al-Fitr, sales are high in markets around the world. But in Gaza, shop owners complain of lack of sales.
This has been the most difficult economic condition in over a decade, and people lack the purchasing power. Most people come to the market just to look around, and they hardly buy anything because the economic situation here is very bad. Things are tough, but the spirit of Eid al-Fitr is here, and people will try to make the best of it.
Despite the harsh circumstances, Palestinians in Gaza are preparing themselves to receive Eid al-Fitr holiday like all Muslims around the world.
Eid celebrations in the besieged Gaza Strip will undoubtedly fall short of being full due to the ongoing Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the US and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, US State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the US and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
For the first time since the presidential election, the Yellow Vests marched around the country, and most expressed disbelief that Emmanuel Macron was re-elected despite his unprecedented repression of the group.
Frankly, we really don't understand how Macron could be re-elected. We started over purchasing power, and it's worse than ever. I guess people need a knife to their throats to come protest anymore?
They were met by a huge police presence, armed to the teeth. The government continues to intimidate yellow vests, but also the average person from rejoining the demonstrations. Intimidating deterrence is also being used to keep journalists from covering the group. In the yellow vest demonstration the day before the first round of voting, a journalist from a top French media was fined for allegedly illegally demonstrating while simply reporting on the yellow vests.
We'll never stop demanding for citizens' referendums, purchasing power, decent pensions, and the ability to have some money left at the end of the month. After the legislative elections in June and the summer vacation, social unrest will explode this fall.
Thousands of devoted yellow vests will continue to turn out every Saturday in Paris alone, and they say others will put their yellow vests back on when they see Macron's plans for his second term.
Emmanuel Macron will continue to be the president of the rich and will continue to march. People will eventually recover their good sense and realize the only way to change politics is to join us in the streets.
Nobody expected the yellow vests to stop marching. Now we'll see if they can last for the next 5 years. Global May Day protests will see establishment forces, such as unions and political parties, march nationwide in favor of workers' rights, but also to express major dissatisfaction with the presidential election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the month of Ramadan is coming to an end, Muslims are gearing up to pick the best clothes to get dressed up for one of their biggest festivities, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. This exhibition gives a glimpse of local costumes of several Muslim countries, from Tunisia and Egypt all the way to Afghanistan and Iran.
On Eid al-Fitr and other important festivities in Tunisia, men wear this white costume and women dress like me or the clothes that you see behind me. They are our traditional clothes.
The shirt this man is wearing is made from a Syrian cloth called the maska. It's a famous Syrian cloth that's made out of silk and cotton. Syrian men wear them in celebrations such as weddings and also during our festivities such as Eid al-Fitr.
Aside from showcasing their costumes, the participating nations also get to introduce their Ramadan traditions and what they have for iftar breakfast.
In Syria, it's customary to break our Ramadan fast with our traditional appetizers such as fattoush and tabbouleh. In my city, Aleppo, we start with dairy such as hot milk. Afterwards, we eat the main dish, which varies from a city to the other.
In Afghanistan, we cook our delicious gulani and ashak for Ramadan breakfast. These foods actually are cooked for our dearest guests in other months of the year.
Organized jointly by Iran's Echo Office and the Culture Ministry, the event seeks to bring about a stronger bond between Muslim nations by sharing their cultures and traditions.
Here, Muslims get together to find their commonalities and at the same time learn about their differences. The expo also brought exhibitors coming from ECO member states. The reason we held it in the holy month of Ramadan is to say that despite all our differences, all of us are Muslims and need to unite.
Muslims say Ramadan brings them together more than any other time, since they all practice the same religious tasks throughout the month. And as the call to prayers resonated in the exhibition, all fasting Muslims left the expo for a shared iftar breakfast.
Despite all the differences in languages, costumes, and even Ramadan meals, people here say they feel like they're one nation, since they all come from Muslim countries. And organizers say this is what Ramadan offers, a taste of peace and friendship that transcends all differences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Hardly a day passes by without some Islamophobic incident occurring in the Western world, says Khadija Ali Ryder in an article published under the heading Quran Burning Episodes Reflect Anti-Islam Animus of Western Politicians. Stay tuned for more. Hardly a day passes by without some Islamophobic incident occurring in the Western world. Anti-Muslim hatred has long surpassed the stage of verbal abuse. It has now become acceptable to murder peaceful Muslims in cold blood in their places of worship as well as on the streets. We will recall such murders shortly, but first let us consider what is underway in Sweden, a country supposedly known for its tolerance and easygoing lifestyle. An extremist right-wing Danish-Swedish politician, Rasmus Paludan, has been on a Quran-burning crusade that has resulted in violence in several Swedish cities. Paludan leads the group Hardline that expresses extreme hatred of immigrants and Islam. His acts are not only sacrilegious but also extremely offensive to Muslims, especially in the blessed month of Ramadan. Ramadan is the month in which the Noble Quran was revealed from on high. Muslims make extra effort in this month to recite the Quran and study it. Paludan's decision to indulge in his criminal act is therefore doubly offensive. He, of course, couches his criminal acts under the rubric of free speech. What has free speech to do with burning the Quran, a divine book that nearly 2 billion Muslims follow worldwide? Paludan makes no secret of his anti-Muslim hatred. He said in a December 2018 video, "The enemy is Islam and Muslims. His final solution for Muslims has a familiar ring." The son of a Swedish father, we are not sure if he is even a legitimate child, but such issues are moot in a liberal societies like Sweden or Denmark, where women and men indulge in all kinds of promiscuous behavior. Paludan first came to public attention in 2017 when he started making anti-Muslim YouTube videos. He started his scandalous acts in Denmark by burning the Quran in public. Denmark gained notoriety for being the first to publish insulting cartoons of the noble prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as far back as 2005. They came to be called the Danish cartoons and were quickly taken up by such other racist publications as Charlie Hebdo in France. The floodgates of abuse of the Prophet of Islam and desecration of the Noble Quran were opened. Racist politicians have taken up such racism and Islamophobia to new heights. In France, for instance, Politicians competing for the presidency try to outpace each other in their verbal attacks on Muslims and Islam. France was also the first country in Europe to place ban Muslim girls from wearing the hijab in the state schools as early as 2004. And in another move reflective of the moral degeneration of such societies, in France, a girl is allowed to have illegal relationships at 15, but she does not have the right to wear hijab before turning 18. Poland's Islamophobic acts are aimed at drumming up support ahead of Danish legislative elections in September. There is a constituency that responds to such racist cant. Even they constitute a minority. Governments, for some strange reason, seem to pander to these racists and bigots, reflecting the deep-seated hatred of Islam. The Danish-Swedish politician has also faced jail sentences, albeit for a short duration, for racism and defamation, but these have proved insufficient to deter him from his criminal acts. His group, Hardline, did not win a single seat in the last Danish national elections in 2019. Poulsen hopes that by his anti-Islamic antics, he will gain some support, since he plans to run again in June 2023 vote. So far, he has failed to garner the necessary number of signatures to even secure his candidature. While Poulsen may fail to get the requisite signatures, his Quran burning campaign is aimed at normalizing Islamophobia in society. Such normalization leads to attacks on Muslims, resulting in the death of innocent people. Who is unaware of the murderous assault on the Quebec City Mosque on January 29, 2017, that resulted in the murder of 6 worshippers and injury to 19 others? Or the New Zealand mosque attacks in Christchurch that led to the murder of 51 Muslim worshippers as they gathered for Friday prayers in March 2019. In June 2021, 4 members of the same family were mowed down by a truck in London, Ontario. Apart from uttering platitudes, politicians have done little to address this serious threat to the survival of their Muslim citizens. It seems as if they agree with the attackers, even if they utter verbal condemnations of such acts. In some instances, even verbal condemnation is lacking. Instead, politicians have joined in denigrating Muslims, as is evident in France, Britain, and a host of other Western countries.
Imam Rida Masjid, leading imam for Imam Rida Center, was Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo. We might say that it was only for Moroccan people, although other people who were interested in Sharia school of thought, including African people, they would go to this Islamic center.
And Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo was trying to extinguish the fire, but he was not unfortunately successful and he was martyred.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are 2 guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So the new series of the program, The Teacher, is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, philosophers, jurists, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam, especially the Shiite ones, who dedicated their life into spreading Islam and the Shiite Islam all around the world. For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the outstanding Shiite clerics and preachers of Islam, Abdullah al-Dahduh. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you this episode. Give us some details about the early life and the education of Abdullah al-Dahduh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Abdullah al-Dahduh, born in 1966 in Morocco, then moving to Belgium when he was a child and growing up in Belgium, going to the schools over there and learning French language. Then as a religious man, he started to get to know about Shia school of thought, and he was really interested to Ahlul Bayt school of thought. And he converted to Shiism. In order to complete his knowledge and studying on Shiism, he moved to Iran. Mm-hmm. And he went to some schools, and he went back to Belgium, completed his studies in the university in Belgium. Again, he came back to Iran in order to complete his Islamic studies in Jamaatul Mustafa al-Alamiyya.
Oh, really? Was he a student of Jamaat?
Yes.
In Iran. Okay,
and
cool.
And then you might say when he went back again to Belgium, mainly Brussels, he started his tablighi life.
Yes.
As the leader of the Ahlul Bayt community, which is mainly for the Morocco people. Mm-hmm. Because in Belgium and Brussels, we have different communities. We have Iranian communities, Iraqi communities. Each and every of these communities, they've got their Islamic center. But Imam Ridha Masjid, which was being lead, or the leading Imam for Imam Ridha center, was Sheikh Abdullah Dahduh. Mm-hmm. We might say that it was only for Moroccan people, although other people who were interested in Sharia school of thought, including African people,
yes,
they would go to this Islamic center, and other people from other communities.
So
but
were,
mainly okay. This community was for the Moroccan people. Yeah.
So there were Islamic centers before Sheikh Abdullah Dahduh goes to Brussels? Okay, over there. But special centers for the Moroccans, people from the same country he was born, in Brussels, Belgium, and he was leading the Shiite center over there, isn't it?
Yeah, this is actually what I said. Imam Ridha Islamic Center,
yes.
Or you may say Islamic, actually Imam Ridha Masjid, is one of the masjid for the Shia community.
Yes.
And mainly this community was the Moroccan people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdavi. Sheikh Ziyanian, let's get to some of his tablighi or preaching efforts over there. What are they, Sheikh Abdullah al-Dahduh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my brother, dear Sheikh Mahdavi, mentioned, he started his tablighi actions and preaching activities after returning back from the second trip that he had in Iran, and completed his Islamic studies in Jamaatul Mustafa. Then he came back to Belgium. He started his tablighi activities and preaching activities in Brussels in Masjid al-Imam Ridha alayhi salam. And he was not only giving lectures there. Besides giving lectures and inviting people, he wrote a book that is Al-Hurriya fil Islam wal Gharb. That means the freedom in Islam and the West. And also he was involved in publishing a magazine that was in French language. The name was Shu'ab al-Hikmah and was welcomed by European people, Muslims, in some countries. That the subject of this magazine was some, you know, legislative or we may say theological issues.
Yes.
So he was a member of the World Assembly of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam and was invited to give lectures in different countries. He had many visits and trips to Iran to participate in different conferences and also in different countries. Another important point that we should mention about Sheikh Abdullah al-Dahduh is that he welcomed African Muslims and African Shia people that were living in Belgium. You know, sometimes in some centers and masjids we see in different countries that unfortunately, this is not common, but okay. Sometimes we see this, that some ethnic issues are involved and are, you know, entered into the mosques and masjids. Some people, they do not allow other nationalities to enter their mosques. This is not something, you know, acceptable by Islam.
Yes.
Of course, it's few, but we should be aware that we should stand against it and try to erase it completely.
Is it sometimes because of the standards of the living of that Western country? Or the laws, for example?
No.
No?
It's rooted in the cultures of people.
Okay.
You know, we as Iranians, maybe we are more comfortable to
have connection with the Iranians.
Yes.
For example, Iranians, Iraqis, Lebanese, Africans have their own communities over there.
Exactly, this is the case.
This must not be the case.
Yeah.
The communities must welcome each ethnic group too.
Yeah, So that's the point that Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo focused on and tried to invite African people who were living in Belgium and Brussels especially to that mosque and welcomed there. No difference, they were from Morocco or from different countries. But, you know, maybe these people were not welcomed in different centers. And this was not a good point. And this is not only in Europe. In different countries, I have seen this, that some nationalities are more welcoming to their own, you know, friends from their own countries, not other nationalities.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziania. So, Sheikh Mahdavi, give us a picture of the Muslim communities and the Islamic communities in Belgium. Because Abdullah Dahdo was working over there, he was active over there in preaching Shiite Islam. What communities do we have over there? How many? And give us some details about Islamic communities.
Okay. Actually, the population of Belgium is 11 million people. From this 11 million people, above 400,000 people are Muslims. And among this 400,000 people, something around 30,000 are Shia. And I've heard from some of the citizens who are living in Brussels, specifically Brussels, they are saying that Brussels is the same as the Qom. They are saying that Brussels is the Qom to Europe.
Really?
Well, because the actually appearance of the city is really looking like a Muslim country or Muslim city, because most of the women are wearing hijab and you see masajid here and there.
Okay.
Among the Shia community, with this population of 30,000 people, we have four masjid. This is besides Islamic center, because as far as I know, at least Iranian community, they themselves, they right now they have three leading centers. That these three leading centers are not included under those masajid.
Okay.
So in such small city, for one community, as mean Shia community, to have four masjid, that is something big, specifically in the Europe. So before we get into the actually last scene of the life of Sheikh Abdullah, I think this is good to talk about the Muslim environment in that city. The time Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo got martyred actually is the peak time of ISIS.
Okay.
And we see how the activities of ISIS is going to affect other Muslim environment here and there. Doesn't matter if you are living in the heart of the Europe. Why? Because we have a big community of Muslims. So this big community, among their leaders, they are going to get effect. I mean, those negative effect of the extremism, which is being practiced by some sort of Muslims.
Okay.
And the result of this is the clashes and conflicts among Muslim denominations, for which we can see something like this happen. I think our brother will speak about that much better.
About the details of his shahada.
Yeah.
So he was martyred over there. And that's all right. You know, this ISIS look at the life of the Muslims all here and there, I think culminated and led into a kind of a separation, sedition, disagreement among the Muslims This is how the Wahhabis and, you know, out of law, spirits say, or extremist Muslims look at the religion of Islam. And this is very much different from the peaceful talks and the efforts that people like Abdullah Dahto had in Brussels. Okay, so Sheikh Ziyaniyah, he was martyred. How?
Yes, he was the imam of the mosque at Ridha, and yes. He went into the mosque for praying Salatul Maghrib. He was preparing the mosque for Jama'ah prayer, and suddenly the glass of the window was broken, and somebody threw a fire into the mosque, and the mosque was, burned. And Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo was trying to extinguish the fire, but he was not, unfortunately, successful, and he was martyred. Of course, there are some, narrations that they may say that one of these takfiri people entered the mosque and hit him by a hammer that killed him at the scene. Okay. But some others say, no, he was martyred by
the
flames.
The killer, the assassinator, was a takfiri one?
Yes, they were three people, takfiri people, that they were giving some slogans regarding takfiris when they were burning the mosque.
That's all right.
And there's a documentary also made by an Iranian director regarding the life of Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo under the title of Qognus, that
Phoenix.
In English, we call it Phoenix.
Yes.
And the title is, good for him because Qognus and Phoenix is burned.
According to Iranian mythology or the Persian
and also in other, in other myths.
Fire, yes.
And Phoenix is burned in fire.
Yes.
And Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo also was martyred fire. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul and place him beside Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasallam and Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Okay. His body was taken out to his homeland in Morocco.
Yes.
And he was buried over there.
In Tangier.
In Tangier, that's right. But the case is that the court of Belgium, we can say, imprisoned the assassinator only for 27 years, because of the killing of somebody. But according to their own laws, for 27 years for imprisonment. That's all right. This was the life of Abdullah Dahdo.
And he was martyred in 2012.
12, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. 10 years ago. That's right. During namaz and the prayer time and salat time, he was martyred and passed away. May Allah bless his soul. And may Allah protect all the muballighs, and muballighas who are trying their best in order to preach Shia Islam all across the world through peaceful coexistence and peace talks and peaceful manners. And this is how the religion of Islam invites the other people into itself, embracing Islam through first recognition of the sources, recognition of the ulama, through tahqiq and through peaceful talk. There is no force, there is no killing, there is no assassination. And all these extremist groups and extremist, actions that we could see by some groups are under the flag of Islam, but they are not Muslims. Believe me, these people are not Muslims. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyaniyah.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, talking about Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ Shia and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.